All right, many popular video doorbells that many of you use can easily be hacked. Tumblr and WordPress joined a data sale train for AI. Nevada is assaulting encryption and a lot of other fun stories. So welcome to Surveillance Support 169, where we're dedicated to keeping you private and secure with the latest news in the past week. I'm Henry from TechLore.
I'm Nathan from The New Oil, and you have a weird definition of fun.
Yeah, well, the news is always fun here. Before we get into it, just a quick little thing. We have a new RSS feed, so I did set up a redirect, so you should still be receiving this, but just be aware if you aren't receiving this, if you're watching the video and you haven't been updated on the audio podcast for whatever reason, just double check the RSS feed. I'll leave it linked down in the description so you all can have a direct link to that, but you shouldn't have to use it again because everything should automatically redirect. On that note, we also did some changes as to how we do the patron-only exclusive VIP feed, and if you're on Patreon, we have that linked there, and it also came along with some other things that we're changing around with Patreon in terms of how we organize things, and it looks a lot prettier, I think. And so, yeah, lots of fun stuff over there. And on that note, join our Patreon if you want to support this podcast. We just made some fresh changes over there, so if you want to check those out, we'll leave them down in the description. If you don't like Patreon, we're also on LibrePay, and if you don't like LibrePay, we also accept Monero. Trying to give different options for all of you. And also, I forgot to mention this, but someone sent us like half XMR like a month ago or so. So thank you to whoever that was. We don't know who you are, but whoever did that, thank you very much. I will dive into the highlight story and talk about how your doorbells can be easily hijacked. So the nonprofit Consumer Reports published research that detailed 4 security and privacy flaws in cameras made by Eken, a company based in Shenzhen, China, which makes cameras branded as Eken, but also apparently Tuck and other brands. These are relatively cheap doorbell cameras that were available on an online marketplace like Walmart and Temu, which removed them from sale after Consumer Reports reached out to the companies to flag the problems. These doorbell cameras, however, are still available elsewhere, and yeah, not just Walmart. So according to Consumer Reports, the most impactful issue is that if someone is in close proximity to a Eken doorbell camera, they can take full control of it by simply downloading its official app called Awit, and putting the camera in parry mode by simply holding down the doorbell's button for 8 seconds. Awit's app has more than 1 million downloads on Google Play, suggesting it is widely used. At that point, the malicious user can create their own account on the app and scan a QR code generated by the app by putting it in front of the doorbell's camera. This process lets the malicious user add the doorbell to their own account, allowing the malicious user to gain control over a device that once originally associated with the homeowner's user account. One mitigating factor is that once this process is over, the owner of the camera does get an email alerting them that their device has changed ownership, but still probably not an issue you want happening or having to worry about in the first place. The other issues highlighted by the nonprofit org are that the doorbells broadcast the owner's IP address over the internet. They broadcast still images captured by the cameras, which can be intercepted and seen by anyone without needing a password. And they broadcast the unencrypted name of the local Wi-Fi network that the doorbell connects to over the internet. This research shows that, once again, consumers have no way to know whether internet-connected smart devices online have the appropriate privacy and security measures in place, and that online marketplaces cannot be trusted to vet what they sell until someone from the outside, like Consumer Reports in this case, points out that the products are not safe. And this reminds me, I think, was it Anchor? That was the Linus Tech Tips sponsor who had also a smart doorbell camera. And they promised end-to-end encryption, they promised all these privacy-friendly things, and it was doing none of it, and it was actually readily hackable, and they actually dropped them as a sponsor because of that. Was it Anchor Eufy? Anchor finally comes clean about its Eufy security cameras. Okay, yeah, okay, Anchor's yep, Eufy.
So it was Anchor.
So, cool. Yeah, just take away, be careful with your smart devices, people. Like, really, think about what you're connecting to your home network and your home internet, because one compromised device can really jeopardize your other devices too.
I know the really popular take, there's kind of the whole take of like, we need to educate people more. And then there's like another take that's like, well, no, we just need to make things easier for people and we need to make security the default. And I think both of those things are true simultaneously. And I think this proves why we can't just focus on make things easier for people. Cause like that sounds like a really easy setup. Hold the button, scan the QR code, boom. And like, there's only so easy you can make things before it's easy for everyone. So I think we really need to take a double pronged approach where we do need to make security the default and we do need to make privacy the default. But at the same time, like I wrote a whole blog post about this where I used reading comprehension as the, or like, not comprehension, just reading, the ability to know how to read as an example. Like 200 years ago, not everyone needed to know how to read because everybody was a subsistence farmer. It didn't really matter. Maybe a little longer than that, but 250, 300 years ago. But like, that's not the world we live in anymore. Now you have to know how to read. That's a basic skill. It's kind of the same thing with tech. 50 years ago, nobody had to know how to program because that was only for nerds and like NASA scientists. Nowadays, everybody's walking around with a computer. I've got a computer on my wrist right now as we record, not to mention all the ones in front of me. Like, it needs to go both ways, because otherwise we can only make things so easy before it's just hit a button and now anybody can do it. And that's bad. All right, data breaches. So we'll start off with Loan Depot, who says about 17 million customers had personal data and social security numbers stolen during cyber attacks. So this is kind of an update. This took place back in January, and we've kind of been waiting for more details to unfold. We may have covered this in the past, but I don't think so, because we didn't really have details. Now we know that the loan and mortgage giant said in a data breach notice filed with the Maine Attorney General that data includes names, dates of birth, email and postal addresses, financial account numbers, and phone numbers. And then, of course, also includes social security numbers, which Loan Depot collected from customers. The total number of affected customers rose from 16.6 million as initially disclosed to federal regulators last month, which did not say what specific customer data had been stolen.
Next data breach. Ransomware gang claims they stole 6 terabytes of Change Healthcare data. So this is the Black Cat Al5 ransomware gang has officially claimed responsibility, or Alpha, my bad, whatever they want to call themselves, has claimed responsibility for a cyber attack on Optum, a subsidiary of United Health Group, which led to an ongoing outage affecting the Change Healthcare platform. Change Healthcare is the largest payment exchange platform used by more than 70,000 pharmacies across the U.S. They claim that they stole source code from them and sensitive information belonging to many partners, including the U.S. military's TRICARE health program, the Medicare Federal Health Insurance Program, CVS Caremark, MetLife, HealthNet, and tens of other health care insurance providers. The sensitive data stolen from Change Healthcare contains a wide range of information on millions of people, including their medical records, insurance records, dental records, payment information, claim information, patients' personal information, like their phone numbers, addresses, social security numbers, email addresses, and more, active U.S. military, Navy personnel, personal information data as well. And yeah, pretty much everything you need to know about someone. So, not a great one.
20 million Cutout.pro user records have been leaked on a breach forum. So Cutout.pro is an AI-powered photo and video editing platform used for image enhancement, background removal, diffusion, colorizing, old photo restoration, and content generation. From samples seen by Bleeping Computer, the data that was leaked includes user ID and profile picture, API access key, account creation date, email address, user IP address, mobile phone number, password and salt used in hashing, I'll come back to that, user type and account status. Have I Been Pwned's founder told Bleeping Computer that he independently verified through multiple matches from the leaked email addresses, confirming that password reset requests went through. Bleeping Computer also confirmed yesterday that emails listed in the data leak match Cutout.pro users. And both Bleeping Computer and Troy Hunt tried to contact this company and received no response. The last thing I want to add is I noted in here, they made a comment about MD5 hashes are deprecated and can be easily broken these days. But I didn't see an actual statement that passwords were stored in MD5, but that seems to be the implication.
I've never been to one of these, but Golden Corral is a restaurant chain, and they have impacted, well, almost 200,000 people in a data breach, 183,000. And for those who don't know, which I think I've seen maybe commercials, but I didn't really know, it's an all-you-can-eat buffet and grill in almost 300 locations in the U.S. and Puerto Rico. And this was discovered while investigating the incident that the stolen information could include employee, dependent and beneficiary names, social security numbers, financial account information, driver's license numbers, medical information, username and passwords, and health insurance information. So it looks like it's definitely at minimum hit Golden Corral employees, and it's uncertain if it's hit people outside of employees, but not great.
All right, and our last one. Oh my God. Okay, I don't have time to rant this week, so just fill in the rant about how screwed up this is. Resita Ransomware wants $3.6 million for children's stolen data. Children of a cancer ward, no less. They've claimed a cyber attack on the Lurie Children's Hospital in Chicago at the start of the month. Lurie is a leading pediatric acute care institution in the U.S. that provides care to over 200,000 children annually. The cyber attack forced the healthcare provider to take its IT systems offline and postpone medical care in some cases. So that is, even for criminals, that is a new level of low.
Company news. We're going to start with Tumblr and WordPress, who are now going to sell users' data to train AI tools. This is the exact types of data from each platform going to each company are not spelled out in documentation we've reviewed, but internal communications reviewed by 404 Media make clear that deals between Automattic, the platform's parent company, and OpenAI and Midjourney are imminent. The internal documentation details a messy and controversial process within Tumblr itself. One internal post made by Kyle Gage, a product manager at Tumblr, states that a query made to prepare data for OpenAI and Midjourney compiled a huge number of users' posts that it wasn't supposed to. It is not clear from Gage's post whether this data has already been sent to OpenAI and Midjourney, or whether Gage was detailing a process for scrubbing the data before it was to be sent. Engineers are working on compiling a list of post IDs that should not have been included, and that password-protected posts, DMs, and media flagged as CSAM and other community guideline violations were not included. Automatic plans to launch a new setting on Wednesday that will allow users to opt out of data sharing with third parties, including AI companies. If you change your mind later, we also plan to update any partners about people who newly opt out and ask that their content be removed from past sources and future training. I'd be curious how they did that. But what remains unclear is whether self-hosted WordPress blogs that use automatic plugins like Jetpack to connect those blogs with Automatic's infrastructure are subject to the company's AI scraping deals. And Nate wants to mention he just did a video about redact.dev, which is a way to essentially delete some of those old posts if you don't want to deal with this anymore. Yeah, so we're already seeing companies start to move in this direction. I know we just covered, I think, Reddit last week, who also is starting to sell posts to AI. All it takes is one big player and everyone goes, well, I guess that's okay. So it looks like other people are hopping on this. And on this note, a WordPress firehose allows AI companies to buy access to 1 million posts a day. This was in September in 2023, and they quietly changed the language of a developer page explaining how to access a firehose of roughly 1 million daily WordPress posts, to add that the feeds are intended for partners like search engines, artificial intelligence products, and market intelligence providers who would like to ingest a real-time stream of new content from a wide spectrum of publishers. Before then, this page did not note the AI use case. Automatic has been selling access to this firehose of posts for years for a variety of purposes. This includes selling access to self-hosted blogs and websites that use a popular plugin called Jetpack. These posts have been directly available via a data partner called SocialGist, which markets its services to social listening companies, marketing insight firms, and increasingly AI companies. Tumblr has its own firehose, and Tumblr posts are available via SocialGist as well. Almost every platform has some sort of post firehose API or way of accessing huge amounts of user posts. Famously, Twitter and Reddit used to give away these for free. Now they do not, and charging access for these posts has become big business for those companies. This firehose also means that the average user doesn't and can't know what companies are getting direct access to their posts and what they're being used for. And after this article is published, Automatic told 404 Media that it is deprecating the firehose, saying, "We have been deprecating the old firehose for several months."
Our next story comes from Meta, who will start collecting quote-unquote anonymized data about Quest headset usage. In an email sent to Quest users on Monday, Meta notes that it currently collects, quote, "the data required for your Meta Quest to work properly," unquote. Nice and vague, just like they like it. Starting with the next software update, though, the company will begin collecting and aggregating quote-unquote anonymized data about device usage from Quest users. That anonymized data will be used for things like, quote, "building better experiences and improving MetaQuest products for everyone." This includes, but I think is not limited to, audio data, like when your microphone preferences are enabled to animate your avatar's lips and face movements, certain data about hand, body, and eye tracking, such as tracking quality and the amount of time it takes to detect your hands and body, fitness-related information, such as the number of calories you burn, how long you've been physically active, and your fitness goals and achievements, information about your physical environment and its dimensions, such as the size of walls, surfaces, and objects in your room and the distances between them and your headset, voice interactions used when making audio commands or dictations, including audio recordings and transcripts that might include any background sound that happens when you use those services. These recordings and transcripts are deleted immediately in most cases, according to Meta. Information about your activity in virtual reality, including the virtual reality events you attend. So basically everything. Meta's help page also lists a small subset of additional data that headset users can opt out of sharing with Meta, but there is no indication that Quest users can opt out of the new anonymized data collection policies entirely. These policies only seem to apply to users who make use of a Meta account to access their Quest headset, and those users are also subject to Meta's wider data collection policies. Those who use a legacy Oculus account are subject to a separate privacy policy that describes a similar but more limited set of data collection practices. Or so we thought, because then today, Meta says it's deleting all Oculus accounts at the end of the month. I'll just quote there's like one relevant paragraph. In an email sent to users, the company says it will delete Oculus accounts on March 29th, 2024, preventing you from reactivating or retrieving your apps, in-app purchases, store credits, and more. You'll lose your achievements, friends list, and any content you created with your Oculus account if you don't migrate to a Meta account before then. Does anybody remember when Meta said that they weren't going to force people to make a Facebook account to use when they bought Oculus? I love those liars. That's all I got.
So next story is kind of a partial win. So the EU has been cracking down on Apple and preventing them from doing a lot of their shenanigans on iOS and forcing them to open things up to consumers. And Apple is throwing many tantrums, one of which was pretty much eliminating a feature that they've supported almost since the first iPhone, essentially. In fact, the first iPhone, which is progressive web apps and pinning them to your home screen. And actually, they've been improving this feature, and we've talked about how now progressive web apps now include things like push notification support and other cool things on iOS, which is awesome. And Apple said, we're not doing that. Just in the EU, we're going to stop allowing you to use web apps. But there's been a lot of outrage, and Apple has now completely reversed that decision. With a caveat, you still have to use a WebKit browser for this, which, again, is not actually what they're doing in the rest of the world, where they actually are allowing you to use web apps in other third-party browser engines. Here's the asterisk there, because in the EU, they're required to open up other browsers to other browser engines. Outside the EU, they are not doing that. But outside the EU, they're allowing other people to use progressive web apps in their apps. In the EU, they don't want to do that. So there's still a little bit of a discrepancy now between the EU and outside of the EU, and I think it's pretty obvious why Apple wouldn't want other browsers who have supported web apps for the last decade to not be able to use progressive web apps in the third-party web browsers. So I would say this is a big win. So Apple is going to maintain progressive web app support, but they still haven't caved in allowing web app support in third-party browsers, which is still a big deal, I think.
Google is blocking RCS on rooted Android devices. Google is cracking down on rooted Android devices, blocking multiple people from using the RCS message feature in Google Messages. Users with rooted phones have made several reports on the Google Messages support page, Reddit, and XDA's web form over the past few months, finding that they're suddenly unable to send or receive RCS messages. One example from a Reddit user shows that RCS messages would simply vanish after hitting the send button. Several reports also mention that Google Messages give no indication that RCS chat was no longer working and was still showing as connected and working in Google Messages. The Google Communications Manager said that the company is, quote, ensuring that message issuing and receiving devices are following the operating measures defined by the RCS standard, unquote, in a bid to prevent spam and abuse on Google's messages. So rooting, would this apply to phones with unlocked bootloaders like Lineage, for example? Or is that something totally different?
So there's a thread going on the Techler forum right now where people are pretty much sharing that, yes, it's not just rooted devices. There are certain custom ROMs right now where people cannot use RCS. And there are certain custom ROMs which still use Google Play services in certain environments where this isn't an issue. But then you're still going through Google. So that's kind of the caveat there. So depends on the ROM, essentially. But it's unfolding. I'm still seeing what people are saying. This is a pretty new thread. This is pretty cool. I mean, okay, it's a cool concept. What they're doing isn't as cool. So a very common attack is essentially stealing people's cookies. So someone can pretty much infect your system with malware, steal your browser cookies, and then they can log in. Even if you have 2FA, it's a very easy way to bypass 2FA, because if you can steal the cookies that are used to log into a website, you can pretty much log in and impersonate that user. PayPal has filed a patent for a new method to detect stolen cookies. And they don't really talk about how they're doing this, but I guess the concern here, I mean, A, again, it's cool that they're trying to address this. What's not cool is the second part of the story, which is, as with all patents, there's no guarantee that the tech described in the document will reach consumer portals in that form or another, but it shows that stolen web cookies for unauthorized logins are enough of a problem to deserve new protection mechanisms. And it's worth acknowledging that this is a patent, and it's not like they're publishing a research article or what their protocols are or what they're looking to do. So, yeah. That's something I'd be thinking about. So PayPal's working on something, could be cool, but it's filed under a patent. So if it's cool, who knows who can get access to that technology.
All right, and our last story is just another PSA. Instagram is working on a friend map feature that would let you track friends' locations. The opt-in feature, which is similar to Snapchat's Snap Map, would allow users to see their friends' locations in real time. The company says the feature is an internal prototype and is not being tested externally. The screenshots also indicate that the location data would be end-to-end encrypted, so I guess there's that. You could choose to share your location with followers who follow you back, your close friends list, or no one at all. The map would also feature a ghost mode setting that would hide your last active location. I don't know. I feel like, obviously, I would say we would recommend you turn that off most likely, but I think we're more, I'm more sharing just in case anyone you know is using Instagram. You might want to let them know, like, hey, be on the lookout for this coming out possibly in the next few months, and probably turn it off if you don't want it.
All right, and research. Here come the AI worms. I want to have some worms someday and like compost. But the AI worms are in a demonstration of the risks of connected autonomous AI ecosystems. A group of researchers have created one of what they claim are the first generative AI worms, which can spread from one system to another, potentially stealing data or deploying malware in the process. It basically means that now you have the ability to conduct or to perform a new kind of cyber attack that hasn't been seen before. To create the generative AI worm, the researchers turned to a so-called adversarial self-replicating prompt. This is a prompt that triggers the generative AI model to output, in its response, another prompt, the researchers say. In short, the AI system is told to produce a set of further instructions in its replies. This is broadly similar to traditional SQL injection and buffer overflow attacks. To show how the worm can work, the researchers created an email system that could send and receive messages using generative AI, plugging into ChatGPT, Gemini, and open source LLM, LLAVA, and they found that two ways to exploit the system were by using a text-based self-replicating prompt and by embedding a self-replicating prompt within an image file. In one instance, the researchers acting as attackers wrote an email including the adversarial text prompt, which poisons the database of an email assistant using retrieval augmented generation, which is a way for LLMs to pull in extra data from outside its system. When the email is retrieved in response to a user query and is sent to GPT-4 or Gemini Pro to create an answer, it actually jailbreaks the GenAI service and ultimately steals data from the emails. In the second method, the researchers say that an image with a malicious prompt embedded makes the email assistant forward the message on to others. The researchers also say that they could extract data from emails, which can be names, telephone numbers, credit card numbers, social security numbers, or anything else that is considered confidential. In a paper covering their findings, researchers say that they anticipate seeing generative AI worms in the wild in the next 2 to 3 years. Despite this, there are ways people creating generative AI systems can defend against these, including using traditional security approaches. A researcher also says that keeping humans in the loop, ensuring AI agents aren't allowed to take actions without approval, is a crucial mitigation that can be put in place. Again, very preliminary stuff, but just kind of cool to see what's going on in an AI world and what are the new security risks that are posed by generative AI. So there are more details in the sources for this one.
That'll take us into politics. We're starting off with the White House urging developers to switch to memory-safe programming languages. For over 35 years, this is quoting the ONCD, I don't know, it's the top cybersecurity person in the country. For over 35 years, the same class of vulnerability, which is memory issues, has vexed the digital ecosystem. The challenge of eliminating entire classes of software vulnerabilities is an urgent and complex problem. Looking forward, new approaches must be taken to mitigate this risk. The highest leverage method to reduce memory safety vulnerabilities is to secure one of the building blocks of cyberspace, the programming language. Using memory-safe programming languages can eliminate most memory safety errors. The article goes on to say that the report builds upon the national cybersecurity strategy signed by Biden back in March 2023, which shifted the burden of defending the country's cyberspace towards software vendors and service providers. The NSA also published guidance in November 2022 on how software developers can prevent memory safety issues, and a similar report from CISA and international partners in December 2023 followed, asking for a transition to memory-safe programming languages to reduce software product attack service by eliminating memory-related vulnerabilities.
Florida lawmakers pass a ban on social media for kids under 16, despite constitutional concerns. Well, pretty sure not the first people to try this. So the bill targets any social media site that tracks user activity, allows children to upload material and interact with others, and uses addictive features designed to cause excessive or compulsive use. Supporters point to rising suicide rates among children, cyberbullying, and predators using social media to prey on kids. And out of curiosity, maybe there is a direct tie, but I'd love to see if they can tie the rising suicide rates among children to social media use. And also I want to remind people that the number one leading cause of death in children is not suicide, and it is not car crashes, but it is actually gun violence in the U.S. Just gonna put that out there. Other states have considered similar legislation, but most have not proposed a total ban. In Arkansas, a federal judge blocked enforcement of a law in August that required parental consent for minors to create new social media accounts. Supporters in Florida hope that if the bill becomes law, it would withstand legal challenges because it would ban social media formats based on addictive features such as notification alerts and autoplay videos rather than the content on their sites. But opponents say it blatantly violates the First Amendment and that it should be left to parents, not the government, to monitor children's social media use. The Florida bill would require social media companies to close any accounts it believes to be used by minors and to cancel accounts at the request of a parent or parents. Or request of a minor or parents. Any information pertaining to the account must be deleted. Yeah, very, very interesting approach to try to deal with this. I just don't understand. I think that, yes, we should be trying to keep children safe, but none of these things that we're trying to target towards protecting children, I don't think can't be applied to adults as well, actually. I don't think that having an addictive platform, adults think they're immune to this when they're not, and there's research showing that adults are just as likely to fall for this kind of stuff. And so I would be actually trying to deal with the root issue if it were me, which is try to actually regulate the companies and stop them from having such addictive platforms in the first place so that they're not incentivized to actually keep people on the platforms and to exploit people for every cent that they have for their attention. But maybe I'm just a little optimistic. It's interesting to see what people think the government should and shouldn't be involved in. Because a lot of people from a certain political party don't like when the government tries to regulate companies, but they're fine with the government regulating parenting.
Okay, quoting the article, a law firm acting on behalf of the Nevada Attorney General Aaron Ford has asked a state court to, and I also just realized I'm saying Nevada wrong. Sorry, everyone. Asked a state court to issue a temporary restraining order, or TRO, denying minors access to encrypted communication in Meta's Messenger application. The motion for a TRO follows AG Ford's announcement of civil lawsuits against five social media companies, including Meta, alleging the companies deceptively marketed their services to young people through algorithms that were designed to promote addiction. The legal claim cites a statement from the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children that argues Meta's provision of end-to-end encryption in Messenger, quote, without exceptions for child safety abuse material, place millions of children in grave danger, unquote. The initial complaints, presumably supporting claims, however, have been redacted in the publicly viewable copy of the document, probably because there are none. The motion for a TRO, which contains redactions, also contends that Meta, by encrypting Messenger, has thwarted state officials from enforcing the Nevada Unfair and Deceptive Trade Practices Act. From the filing, this conduct, which renders it impossible for anyone other than private messages sender and recipient to know what information the message contains, serves as an essential tool of child predators and drastically impedes law enforcement efforts to protect children from heinous online crimes, including human trafficking, predation, and other forms of dangerous exploitation. According to the motion for a TRO, Meta's end-to-end encryption stymies efforts by Nevada law enforcement, causing needless delay and even risking the spoilation of critical pieces of necessary evidence in criminal prosecutions. The injunction, if granted, would require Meta to disable end-to-end encryption for all messenger users under 18 in Nevada. Presumably, that would also affect minors using Messenger who are visiting the state. In a Mastodon post, one research scholar at the Stanford Internet Observatory said, I believe this is the biggest attack on encryption in the United States since 2016. And that was when the whole Apple FBI thing happened. For those who don't know, the FBI told Apple they need to decrypt an iPhone. Apple said, we can't. Turned into a whole legal showdown, and then the FBI like magically found a way around it anyways, because they're the FBI. The researcher told the Register that prohibiting Nevada children and only Nevada children from having end-to-end encryption for their online communications would not help children's safety, it would undermine it. Banning children in Nevada from having end-to-end encryption means giving some of the state's most vulnerable residents less digital privacy and security than everyone else. The FTC and other state attorney generals, such as California, have long been clear that it is a consumer protection violation for companies not to give users adequate digital privacy and security, and strong encryption is the gold standard for doing that. It's therefore puzzlingly backward for the Nevada attorney general to argue that Meta is violating Nevada's consumer protection law here, unquote. I know why they do it, but I'm so tired of seeing the think of the children argument, because it is such disingenuous garbage. And every expert out here is like, this is not protecting the children. This is hurting the children more. That's all I have to say.
The next story is pretty nice, actually. So police now need a warrant to get a person's IP address. The Supreme Court rules. Supreme Court of Canada, not the US. So in a 5-4 split decision, the court said a reasonable expectation of privacy is attached to the numbers making up a person's IP address, and just getting those numbers alone constitutes a search. They wrote that an IP address is the crucial link between an internet user and their online activity. Thus, the subject matter of this search was the information these IP addresses could reveal about specific internet users, including ultimately their identity. Writing for the four dissenting judges, Justice Suzanne Cote disagreed with that central point, saying that there should be no expectation of privacy around an IP address alone. The dissenting judges wrote, the evidentiary record in this case establishes that an IP address on its own reveals only limited information. They said the biographical personal information the law was designed to protect are not revealed through having access to an IP address. Police must use that IP address to access personal information that is held by an ISP or a website that tracks customers' IP addresses to determine their habits. The court's decision is based on the case of Andre Bykovitz, who was convicted of 14 online fraud offenses for purchases made from an Alberta liquor store. Police contacted the third-party payment processor and asked for the IP address associated with the purchases without providing a court order or warrant. They gave two IP addresses to the police. Calgary police then went to the internet service provider with a court order to get the names and addresses associated with the IP address. One address belonged to the accused and the other belonged to his father. Police used the names and addresses to get a warrant to search their residence, and the accused were arrested and charged with possession of a third party's credit card and identity documents. At trial, he argued that he was the victim of an unreasonable search and seizure, which is a violation of Section 8 of the Charter of Rights and Freedoms because he had an expectation of privacy with respect to his IP address. RCMP, acting officer in charge of Alert ICE, which is the Internet Child Exploitation Unit for Alberta, told CBC News that in virtually every case, an IP address kickstarts their investigations. It used to be pretty straightforward. This definitely throws a wrench into the machine. It's going to put a lot of children at risk, he said. So I think we've already talked enough today about children, and I think I'm going to leave it there.
Okay, we have a win. I mentioned this briefly last week. The UK's GPS tagging of migrants has been ruled illegal. As part of an 18-month pilot that concluded in December, the UK Interior Ministry, known as the Home Office, forced up to 600 people who arrived in the country without permission to wear ankle tags that continuously track their locations. However, the pilot broke UK data protection law because it did not properly assess the privacy intrusion of GPS tracking or give migrants clear information about the data that was being collected, the UK's Information Commissioner's Office, or ICO, said today. The ruling means that the Home Office has 28 days to update its policies around GPS tracking. Just a quick pause. I didn't get into it last time, and I'm still not going to get into it deep here, but you should listen to the Privacy International podcast that, at least as of now, is still the most recent one, because they talked all about this, and they interviewed one of the undocumented immigrants who had to wear these. I guess technically that doesn't make him documented. But either way, like, he came here on asylum, if I remember correctly, and like this thing has to be charged for like some obnoxious like 6 hours at a time or something, and it's like super obvious, so there's the whole stigma of like, oh, you've got an ankle bracelet on, and it like really confines him in terms of just living his day-to-day life and being able to like walk his kids to school and like go to the grocery store and just it's yeah. You guys really should listen to it. Like, this really did sound pretty horrendous. So speaking of, one of the lawyers at Privacy International said blanket 24/7 GPS surveillance of asylum seekers arriving in the UK runs diametrically opposed to data protection and privacy rights. The UK Information Commissioner said having access to a person's 24/7 movements is highly intrusive, as it is likely to reveal a lot of information about them, including potential to infer sensitive information, such as their religion, sexuality, or health status. Lack of clarity on how this information will be used can also inadvertently inhibit people's movements and freedom to take part in day-to-day activities. And then I just wanted to throw in here at the very end, it says the UK is not the only country that is using GPS tracking devices as an alternative to immigration detention centers. Last year, the US Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency also announced it would start tracking migrants using GPS ankle tags and specifically designed smartwatches.
All right, we're going to keep this quick because I know we've already covered the Flipper Zero story, I think several weeks ago at this point. But there's a petition to save the Flipper Zero in Canada. Canada thinks that the Flipper Zero is this insane hacking device tool thing. And people are going, this is just kind of a research thing that doesn't just have nefarious purposes. And if you ban this, you might as well ban tons of other research tools that people use to investigate how things work. So definitely go check it out in the description and in the source notes. And we'll leave that petition down there if you want to get involved with the Flipper Zero situation.
That'll bring us into free and open source software news. And we have a lot of good news this week. We're going to start off with the Proton Pass Windows app now being available for everyone. I'll quote the relevant parts of the article. Proton Pass is launching its new app for Windows, allowing you to access our password manager from your desktop. As one of our community's most requested features, it's available to everyone starting today. If your subscription includes Pass's premium features, you can also activate offline mode. You can activate it by enabling it in the settings with a single click. And they say we'll announce apps for macOS and Linux in the near future, which, on the one hand, we kind of want to be cynical and poke fun at them and be like, you know, yeah, future, eventually. But to be fair, they're developing past pretty quickly, I feel like. So hopefully that will be out soon.
Next one is from NT, who's most well known for either NT Photos or NT Auth. And they're open sourcing their server. So this is the same code that they're using for their own cloud offering. So it's battle tested and in production. And they really outline that it's not a code dump, but it's the live, breathing, continuously updated repo where they go about their work every day. So for anybody who uses NT, there's a little bit more transparency there on the server end. Not that this isn't a good thing, but there's no way for us to really know that that's really the code that's being run on the server. So just remember that the most important thing with end-to-end encrypted services is the client-side stuff. So keep an eye on the client-side stuff for really anything you use.
Real quick also, Tails 6.0 has been released. Probably the coolest thing, in my opinion, is it now warns you... Well, a few things. It warns you about errors when reading or writing to the USB if you use the persistent storage. There's automatic remote device mounting and simplified Veracrypt support. And as far as the automatic device mounting, don't worry. There is also protection against malicious USB devices. Maybe worry. I don't know. But either way, they thought about that because that was the first place my brain went. There's a dark mode and a nightlight. It's easier to use Gmail and Thunderbird. Easier screenshots and screen shares, I think. I think I may have paraphrase that wrong. Easier to screencast and screen share, 5 more languages supported for suggested passphrases, and a lot more. There's a lot in this release. So if you are a Tails user, definitely check that out. There's a lot going on in this one. Some cool stuff.
Linux Bros. KDE Plasma 6 is here. And the two big things are a transition to the latest version of their application framework, Qt, and a migration to the modern Linux graphics platform, Wayland. Tons of other stuff, but those seem to be probably the biggest changes. And the Linux Experiment has released a video, and the page is full of announcements. So there's a lot more to it. I've seen some people really excited about this on our forum. Excited enough to even possibly try this over GNOME... ...
So this one's just kind of a quick signal boost. The F-Droid Board of Directors is looking for candidates to be nominated by March 19th. The all-volunteer board serves the F-Droid community of users, developers, and contributors working to advance the cause of mobile device user freedom. There are potentially 4 seats open on the board. The directors whose terms are ending in the cycle may either step down or choose to seek re-election. Newly elected directors will serve 2-year terms. Please send your candidate nominations by email no later than March 19th anywhere on Earth. You may nominate yourself or others. If nominating others, please first confirm that the nominee is in fact interested. Candidates do not need to be developers. In fact, we need a diverse set of backgrounds and life experiences on the board with a range of skills and perspectives in order to succeed. Current areas of board focus include organizational governance and legal affairs, fundraising and financial management, and community conduct and mediation.
Really quick, we've talked about this a couple times, but Divest OS is a custom ROM, and it was trying to run a fundraiser so they could, well, the main developer, Tavi, could still focus on it, and they hit their goal. So, yay! If any of you donated, then good job, and you helped support this. So, yay. Go community. Woot woot.
All right, that'll bring us into our misfits, and we got some good ones this week. We're starting off with hijacked subdomains of major brands used in a massive spam campaign. This, again, comes from Bleeping Computers, so there's a lot of super technical explanation in the article. That's one thing I really like about them. As the domains belong to trusted companies, they gain the benefit of being able to bypass spam filters and, in some cases, take advantage of configured SPF and DKIM email policies that tell secure email gateways that the emails are legitimate and not spam. Some notable brands that fell victim to this domain include MSN, VMware, McAfee, The Economist, Cornell University, CBS, NYC.gov, PwC, Pearson, the Better Business Bureau, UNICEF, ACLU, Symantec, Java.net, Marvel, and eBay. Clicking on the embedded buttons in the emails takes users through a series of redirections, generating revenue for the threat actors via fraudulent ad views. Ultimately, the user arrives at a fake gateway, security scans, surveys, or affiliate scams. So just be aware of that. Even if things pass the check, you know, be suspicious, be cautious, try to go directly to the website, all the usual greatest hits. But yeah, this one's pretty impressive, so just be on your guard.
GitHub has been besieged by millions of malicious repos in an ongoing attack. Pretty much, they're going in and cloning legitimate repos, and they're making it look like them, so it's hard to distinguish between the malicious and the real repos to the casual eye. The result is millions of forks with names identical to the original one that adds a payload that's wrapped under 7 layers of obfuscation. To make matters worse, some people unaware of the malice of these imitators are forking the forks, which adds to the flood. So most of the forked repos are quickly removed by GitHub, which identifies the automation, but the automation detection seems to miss some repos, and the ones that were uploaded manually survive. The 1% that survive still amount to thousands of malicious repos. So be aware on GitHub for the foreseeable future, and always, honestly. Not that GitHub in particular has anything that's more susceptible to these kind of risks. It's just the most popular. But just anytime you're working with anything with Git and you're just downloading random things from the internet, it's the same stuff. All right, and that is it for the week. Again, we have many popular video doorbells that can be easily hacked, so make sure to check that out and also just keep tabs on what you have around your house. Tumblr and WordPress joined the data sale train. Nevada is assaulting encryption, and a lot of other news this week. Again, we want to thank you for being here. And again, there is a new RSS feed. And again, there are updates on Patreon. So if you want to see what those updates are and you want to engage with our Patreon community, we'd really appreciate that. And we do the Q&A every week, which is asked exclusively by our patrons. And you can be a part of that community. So definitely check that out. And you also get to support this free podcast that we do every week. And if you don't like Patreon, check us out on LiberPay. If you don't like LiberPay, we also support Monero as well. So thank you all for tuning in. Really appreciate you all listening in and taking your privacy and security a little bit more seriously in your daily lives, as well as keeping the people around you a little bit safer as well. So we'll see you next time on Surveillance Report, and peace out.